Hello, pencil drivers, calligraphers, doodlers, ink spellers, and ink slingers, and welcome to another episode of Right Minded. I'm the sometimes wrong-minded Grant Faulkner, and I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Warner, who, if you don't know, recently authored a book. We featured it way back in August or September, I believe. And Brooke, can you give us an update? What's been going on with Write On Sisters? I'm curious if you could share one positive story and one negative one, which I hope you don't have.
Yeah, right. Way back when, in August or September, and such is the shelf life of book these days. But yes, I do have a negative story. But actually, my negative and my positive story are one in the same, because a few weeks after the publication of Write On Sisters, I got a piece placed in Salon, and I was really pleased about it because it had long been a goal of mine to get published on Salon. And so it's a highly personal piece, and therefore it was super nerve-wracking to put it out into the world for people to read. And I did feel very exposed. And the negative part of the story is that I got eviscerated by the trolls in the comment section on Salon. And ultimately, I stopped reading the comments because they were so ridiculous, attacking me. They were baseless and mean-spirited. But this is also the positive, because while the comments were hurtful, I felt that I'd struck a nerve. And there was something powerful about garnering that amount of pushback. It kind of helped me feel that I had tapped into something meaningful. And so even though the commenters couldn't be civilized about the whole thing, I also found myself walking through how to handle that kind of negative feedback. And at the same time, I received a tremendous amount of support. So it was one of these things like a double-edged sword, one of those experiences of simultaneous positive and negative feedback, which is not uncommon, especially in the world of writing. And one quick thing I want to share as an anecdote to all of this is that one of my authors sent me a Facebook message that day sharing that something similar had happened to her a few years earlier. And out of fear and kind of a gut response, she pulled the article off the site where it had been published. And she was urging me to be steadfast and to stay the course. And the positive for me was that her support buoyed me and the support of others. And I didn't consider for 1 minute removing the article. And in the end, I felt really solid and proud of having achieved the goal of getting the piece on Salon, even though there were a lot of naysayers.
Wow, that's quite a story. And I'm sorry that it was, at least for a while, a negative experience, but that's wonderful. It turned positive, and something to learn in that, in those negative moments. Things can tip the other way. And the reason I bring this question up is that sometimes I think people think that once you've published a book that you're living the dream, but it's generally far different than living the dream for most. For one, it's a lot of work to turn from author to marketer, which we've discussed on past shows. And secondly, I think, and perhaps more importantly, the fate of one book can determine the fate of your next books. And that's the thing that struck me about the story of Jamie Ettenberg, our guest today. She had the bad experience of publishing a book, her third book, and it was well received, but it didn't sell particularly well, and her publisher just dropped her. And I have a couple of friends who this happened to recently as well, and it's just devastating. They feel embarrassed. They feel wronged. They're angry. They feel like failures. They hate when people ask about their books or what's coming next, things like that. I think it's akin to going through a divorce on some levels. It can be devastating and hard to recover from. Brooke, since you've worked in publishing, do you have any stories that are similar to this?
Yeah, I mean, countless stories like this, actually, mostly that I hear about. A lot of times authors coming to She Writes Press because they've had an exact same experience of their publisher dropping their book. I'm grateful to have worked myself for small publishers who never do this to an author because of some bottom line financial decisions, but it really is common. And so I know of authors who have gotten big publishing deals, for instance, for a hardcover, which should mean that automatically the paperback is going to follow a year later. But then they're told by the publisher that the hardcover didn't sell well, so that will not be the case, and they won't be publishing the paperback. And this effectively cuts authors off at the knees. And I've worked with authors whose longtime publishers drop them after a bad performance on a book, authors whose publishers don't offer them a follow-up publishing deal on a second or third book, even after they've given them a huge advance. And that's because the book failed to earn out, which means that it didn't earn out its expenses. And I kind of feel like, well, that's the publishing house's problem in the first place for having offered too big of an advance. So basically, yeah. The answer is yes. I've heard hundreds of these stories that I could share, and they are really hard for authors to swallow.
Yeah, definitely. And as writers who want to be published, it's important for us to remember that the agents and editors we deal with can be friendly. They can be our friends. They can be wonderful people. But they're also looking at things through a business lens. And I know of authors whose agents just stopped returning their emails, for example, or they respond curtly if that author is not really producing money for them. It's the equivalent of being ghosted. Fortunately, Jamie came through it. She turned a negative into a positive like you did, Brooke. Before the Middlesteins, her fourth book was published, which was a breakthrough book. She doubled down on her writing career, and I really admire her story. She was massively in debt, putting her expenses on a credit card, and she was even couch surfing, which didn't feel the best at the age of 40. But she knew that writing was what she wanted to do, so she just doubled down and went all in. And that's tough to do at any age, because it could have all gone south. Brooke, have you ever been in a situation like this? Have you rolled the dice with your writing publishing career? I'm thinking that maybe when you started She Writes, you had to take the risk of entrepreneurship and possibly losing it all.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I started She Writes Press, I went all in. And there are those moments in life when you have to take a leap of faith, but it's hard to do and hard to know when is the right time. And most of us, I think, wait till it's past the right time. I think a lot of people will look back at those moments when they finally took the leap and think, yeah, you know, I probably could have done it earlier. And we recently interviewed Jen Pasteloff, and she shared her story about leaving waitressing to pursue this other successful thing that she's now doing, which is leading retreats. But she shared that she basically had to be pushed out, and that she went away to teach a retreat while she was still waitressing, and she failed to get someone to get her shift covered. And so when she came back, the manager said that she needed a doctor's note to be excused from having missed her shift. And that's when she finally found it in herself to say, you know what, no, I quit. And for me with She Writes, I think I did leave at the right time, but I had been thinking about leaving for more than 2 years. And I think that's probably a pretty common incubation period, that you have the inkling of this next thing that you want to do, and then you wait. You know, it might be out of fear or trying to figure things out or getting your ducks in a row. And certainly those were all things that I was doing during those 2 years. So yeah, how about you, Grant? What's the roll the dice moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, it was a roll of the dice moment, but I think more in retrospect, I think youth kind of protected me from knowing that it was a roll of the dice moment. But I was like Jamie in my 20s. Writing was my plan A, my plan B, and my plan C. So any notions of practicality, or most notions of practicality, meaning health insurance or a retirement plan or even a steady job, weren't top of mind. I was just interested in living in different places and traveling as much as I could and writing. But I definitely started developing plan Bs in my 30s. And again, looking in the rearview mirror, I think I was incredibly lucky that I had the luck to have fallen into several jobs that were related to writing and then set me up, at least career-wise. But you know, there's always this tension, always this struggle for every writer about how much to sacrifice for your writing and how much to live an impractical life or impractical in other people's lives. And I'd love to double down now, but I've got these couple kids and a dog, and they all need to be fed. So that's keeping me in my day job for the foreseeable future. But I think what's important for writers to think about is that there's no one way. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. We have to figure out what's right for us. But that's why I like hearing stories like Jamie's, because I think it's inspiring to take risks, since I think we can all get swarmed by all the practicalities around us. And sometimes we need to ponder this irony that doing the dangerous thing just might be the safest thing you can do in the end.
I so agree with you, Grant. And let's take a moment to reflect on the nature of danger and safety on this very short break.
Brooke, you know, I try to find ways to learn that fit into my life, which is one reason I'm excited that today's episode is sponsored by Great Courses, which emphasizes the self-driven, do-it-yourself aspects of learning by giving unlimited access to thousands of lectures by experts on topics, amazing array of topics, especially for writers. You know, I found utopian and dystopian works of literature, a course on ancient Greek history, a course on the secret of writing suspense, course on King Arthur, science fiction as philosophy, and many other courses. Really wonderful.
Yeah, ever since Great Courses started sponsoring our podcast, I have felt my brain and my life expanding. I'm calmer because I'm listening to courses instead of the news. My son and I have cool things to check out together, like life in the world's oceans and the mathematics of games and puzzles. There are 1,827 lectures on science alone.
Wow. And there are a bunch of courses on writing and publishing as well. And I think listeners might be interested in Jane Friedman's publishing course, which includes 24 courses that make up 12 hours of learning. Jane was on Right Minded earlier this year, and she touched on some of these topics, but she goes much more in depth in the course, of course. Pitching, querying, marketing, working with an editor, self-publishing, those are just a few of her topics.
And you can get Jane Friedman's publishing course and access to thousands of other courses by taking advantage of this special offer that Great Courses is giving our listeners. So please sign up, check it out. You can just get a month for free and see how you like it. So do us a favor too and do it, not only because it's good for you, but it's helpful to us. Try your free trial at thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded. And Grant, you made me sing last time and jingles get stuck in your head. So I was just wondering if you might treat us to your baritones for this spot.
Well, I'd rather do an interpretive dance of the URL since we're not on video like Great Courses is. I'll try to drum it. How about that? GreatCoursesPlus.com/rightminded without a hyphen. Did that work? Welcome back, everybody. I'm excited to talk to Jamie Ettenberg, who writes about a lot of topics in a lot of different ways. She has written about food, travel, books, relationships, and urban life for the New York Times Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, the Sunday Times, Longreads, and others. She's also written 7 books, and of special note, her 4th book, The Middlesteins, appeared on the New York Times bestseller list and was also a finalist for both the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Fiction and the St. Francis College Literacy Prize. Her latest, All This Could Be Yours, is coming out basically now. Thanks for joining us, Jamie.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I want to start at the beginning of your writing career, because from what I know about you, it seems like you were a very committed writer from the start, but you didn't pursue the whole MFA route. Instead, you moved around, had adventures, worked, and wrote. And this is exactly what I planned to do, yet somehow I kind of stumbled into an MFA program. Do you think you're a better writer for not getting an MFA, or do you wish you would have?
I don't know. Am I a better writer? I mean, you know, I know MFAs offer amazing opportunities of time, right? Like that's the
Absolutely.
Thing I would love is like, okay, here's two. And if you get paid to go there, you know, that's even better. So it's like, here's 2 years to sit and read and write. That sounds really amazing. But I don't know. I mean, I suppose there's like a language that I don't have that you learn in graduate school. I think the one way that it impacted me is that I don't teach very often, and it would have been harder for me to teach without that MFA. But in terms of being a better writer or worse writer, I mean, it's all about doing the work. You can do the work wherever you are. You don't need a degree or not a degree. You know, I take my job really seriously and I sit down and do the work every day. But I guess an MFA sounds fun.
You can still get one, Jamie. You can still go back.
You know what's so funny is that I thought about it after my 3rd book that I would go and get an MFA because I wasn't selling very well. And I was like, well, maybe I'll get an MFA and I'll be able to teach, and that'll be like a good backup plan for me. Because I had been working in advertising for so long and I didn't really want to do it for the rest of my life.
That said, you've had a very successful career and you're super prolific. You had one huge setback, though, that I think would have knocked some authors out. And that is that in 2010, you published your 3rd book of fiction, The Melting Season, which received very good reviews, but didn't sell very well. And so you were dropped by your publisher. So I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners how that affected you as a writer and how you came back from it.
I mean, what was amazing is that I actually had dinner last night with that editor. And she just got a job as she's now the publisher of Flatiron Books, Megan Lynch. And we were joking about how she was the editor on my 2 worst selling books. And somehow we both have survived. Our careers have survived and thrived. So, but it was really, it was really hard for me. I was really, I was really sad because I thought, oh, I'm working hard. I got dropped as I submitted the Middlesteins to the publisher, and they rejected and said that they didn't want to publish me anymore. And that book to me was the best thing that I'd ever done. And so it was confusing for me because I really thought, oh, but this is so good. This should be good enough, to sort of get me to the next place. And so that was sort of like a hard thing, was like feeling like your inner compass is wrong. But it took about 2 weeks for my agent to sell it somewhere else. So I was really sad for about 2 weeks. And then I did feel a little thrown off of my game. But then I kind of recommitted myself to my writing along the way over the next year until it got published, and just realized that it didn't really matter what I did or what it took. I was going to, just always try to write books forever.
Good plan. Seems to be working out.
I mean, it's not a great plan. It was a plan. Yeah.
Well, I've read that you're called, or you have been called, the Poet Laureate of Family Dysfunction, which I think is a great title. Yeah. And your new book, All This Could Be Yours, certainly centers around some toxic dysfunction. Can you tell us about your new novel and what drew you to it?
Well, let's see. It's about a very bad rich man who, within the first couple of pages, has a heart attack. His name's Victor Tuckman, and he kind of goes into a coma, and he's going to die. And I'm not really giving him away. He's going to die over the course of the book. And it's less about him and more about his family members. I mean, he's done a lot of bad things in his life, in the world, but also to his family members, and they all are kind of coming to terms with his death in various ways. And it's set in New Orleans, which is a city that I have moved to about 4 years ago. So it's my first book that's set there. And it's definitely a love letter to that city. Hopefully, and some, I'm trying not to be cliched when I talk about the city and make and have a fresh take on it. So it is about a dysfunctional family for sure. But it's also just a very American novel set right now.
Well, and tell us about moving to New Orleans as a transplant. Did you feel like you had to do a lot of research to properly capture it? I mean, you just said you didn't want to make it cliche, but it has such a deep history, and it's also a city where history weaves itself through families. So what was that like?
Well, I did. I think part of like the trick of the book is that I had these families, they're mostly outsiders. So that was kind of my access point. And it's, it's a fair... it's fair to write about outsiders in New Orleans. It's a city that has a lot of tourists. It's like one of the top tourist destinations in the world. And it also has a 30% population change post-Katrina. So I think it was okay to write about it. But I also had like a lot of like native New Orleanian characters that sort of popped up as I was writing the book. In terms of research, I did a lot of walking. And I mean, it's the same I do with any book, really, like a lot of walking, driving, exploring, conversations. I had three different native New Orleanians read the book to make sure that I got the facts right. It was an opportunity for me to get to know Louisiana and Mississippi, more. I drove a lot around the region. There's a lot of natural locations. So like my last book was really, it was set in New York, and it was a very urban book. And this, New Orleans is really a city that has a lot to do with being out on the streets and outdoors and in nature, much more than New York City. It was a great opportunity for me to get to know the landscape better.
Yeah, what a great way to explore a city is through a novel. There's an old writing maxim that character is plot. And I read that your books always start with you hear a character's voice first, and that you often like to engage that character in dialogue with other people, even though you won't, maybe won't use that material. Which character drew you into this novel, and did you explore it in similar fashion?
Alex, who is Victor Tuckman's daughter, was the first character that I heard. The sixth chapter in the book was originally the first chapter in the book, and it's Alex sitting with her sister-in-law on the roof of a hotel in downtown New Orleans, and they're gossiping about their family. So Alex was for three drafts, the beginning of the book and the lead of the book, and her thoughts about her family and her being in this hotel and visiting the city she's from Chicago, or she lives in Chicago, I should say. So she was the one that I was like, all right, she's like a great entry for me. She's, you know, a divorced woman, a little bit bitter about her ex-husband, who's extremely handsome. She has a daughter who is, a, you know, an adolescent and is kind of, in a, you know, a little bitchy on occasion. So that was juicy enough for me. That was enough to get going on.
So, Jamie, you wrote a piece in the Times about how people often presume that your novels, this is probably the novels of writers in general, are taken directly from your own life. I really liked this quote from you, though. You wrote, or rather said, how do you even explain the creative process, that there are all these little bits and pieces, that a work of fiction can be a kaleidoscope of your life, looking nothing like the original whole, just made up of shattered bits? Why can't people let fiction be? I like its defiance, and I'd love for you to talk about that. I mean, does the fact that people might interpret your fiction as nonfiction bother you, influence you? You know, what is your take on it?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that was a really beautiful sentence. I can't believe I wrote that. Listen, you guys, it's so bizarre because I'm now at this point, I've been doing publishing books for 14 years. And so you can find all these things that I've said in the past, which may or may not be true. I mean, that is true, but it's just a trip when you start getting, doing interviews years later and people are like, well, you said this in 2003 or whatever. And I'm like, maybe, I believe you. I think I find it more frustrating for the last book in particular, because it was about a single woman. And so everyone just thought, who lived in New York, and everyone just went, it's you. And over the years, like, you know, I wrote The Middlesteins, and that was about a morbidly obese person, and people would meet me and say, oh, you're not fat, and, you know, which I talk about in the piece. It feels unfair. It really feels unfair because we are offering up this gift to people. Like, we are working, often not making very much money at it, or really struggling. And especially if you have a family, you try to find the time to write, and here it is. We've worked so hard, and we're giving you this thing, and people want. It feels like they just want more. Do you know what I mean? Like, feels like, oh, they're entitled to something from you. So I find that like a little bit frustrating when I feel like we already, as writers, not just me, as all writers, give so much of themselves by creating this piece of art. And yes, explaining the process too is really. You know, now that I was just saying that you guys are like, I think maybe my 24th or 25th interview, and I would just like to say thank you for not asking me about my process, unless that question's coming. I don't know. I just think can't you just enjoy it? I mean, my favorite thing in the world is when I go to see a movie or read a book or any, you know, engage with any kind of cultural experience and don't know a thing. And I'm just genuinely surprised. And I think that we're like, you know, probably the world, we're just so used to being inundated with every little detail and fact about whatever it is that you're consuming, all this extra information. And it's like, just let your brain breathe and just enjoy it. Don't you just want to enjoy yourself for a second?
I totally agree. I hate those moments where people try to, that's their first response to your fiction, of looking for what's true about it or what relates to your life. And it's very limiting, I think. Well, Jamie, you are 7 books into a wonderfully successful career. I'm curious, are you the writer you wanted to be when you published your first book, Instant Love?
Oh my gosh. No one has asked me that question before. I mean, I think when you write your first book, you don't know if it's going to get published. Right? Like, you don't know anything about the experience at all. What I am is a working writer, and I'm very grateful for that. I'm really happy about that. I'm really happy. This book so far has gotten really great reviews, so I'm happy about that. I'm always trying to push myself to do something more, to do something better. And I feel like I accomplished that with this book. So I don't know. I mean, I'm like about to be 48 and I'm paying my bills with my art. So feeling okay.
That's definitely a huge, huge success. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Jamie, and best of luck with All This Could Be Yours.
Thank you.
We will be right back with today's takeaway.
Welcome back, everybody, for today's takeaway. You know, when I was preparing for this interview, I realized how little I write about families. I mean, my characters obviously come from families, and mothers and fathers and children and relatives make appearances in them. But I haven't written many stories where the family is the primary setting, where family dynamics are the primary terrain of the story, the central topic. So I'd like to invite writers to go on an excursion into families, whether your story is set on Mars or in my hometown of Oskaloosa, Iowa. Think about a few families you know. It doesn't have to be your own family. What conflicts can you identify? What would your novel be like if, say, everyone came back for a funeral or a wedding or a family reunion, which always all these things tend to produce some sort of drama? So think about a tangled web that you can weave and what drama you can find there.
All right, Grant, thank you for leaving us with that anxiety-provoking prompt. And remember, we'll have more inspiration, less anxiety for you next week on Right Minded. You can download Right Minded on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you all for rating us. Thank you for your comments. We so appreciate it. We'll see you next week.